It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsinites paid a smaller portion of their personal income in state and local taxes than at any time in the last five decades in 2023.
A new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum shows that Wisconsin ranked 34th in the country that year for tax burden. That's a term describing the level of taxes as share of income.
That's a big reversal from 25 years ago when Wisconsin regularly ranked among the top five nationally for the highest tax burden, along states like New York and Maine.
The decline in Wisconsin's tax burden over the years is the result of public policy, and it has had a ripple effect on the state's ability to fund K-12 public schools.
Mark Sommerhauser is a researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. With us in the studio now for a look at the findings. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's great to be here.
All right, number 34 in the country for the tax burden in the 2023 report, the most recent year where we have complete data. Put that ranking in context for us.
Yeah, so 34th actually was a slight change, just a slight increase in the ranking from 35th the year prior. That was an all-time low that we saw at number 35 in 2022. Kind of the bigger picture, as you were alluding to, Rob, is that over the last 20-plus years, Wisconsin has seen a really significant decrease in both our tax burden, you know, relative to ourselves and relative to other states, and we've seen our rank decline very dramatically in that area.
Now, before we dig into what's behind this, I want to address people who might be saying, wait a minute, buddy, I just saw my property tax bill. Seemed pretty high. What's going on there?
Yeah, there definitely are a lot of folks that have seen property tax increases this in the bills that just went out in December, and we have some separate research that's delved into that. What this tax burden number measures is we take all state and local taxes paid by everyone in Wisconsin, and we take that, and that's our numerator, our denominator, we take that as a share of all the personal income earned by all Wisconsinites in the state. And so when we kind of, you know, and the idea there is to try to find a number that, you know, looks at the ability of our state to pay all these state and local taxes. And what we see is that that number has declined from at a high point, about 12.5% to below 9.8% here most recently. And that has put us, again, on decline just looking at that number, but also when we compare where that number ranks compared to other states, we were routinely in the top five in the late 1990s, early aughts, and now we find ourselves in the mid-30s.
What is behind that decline?
So we've seen a series of income tax cuts at the state level, which has probably been the biggest factor and the most consistent factor. We've also seen state policymakers put in place some mechanisms that have limited the ability of local governments to increase property tax levies. And so that has been another piece as well. And then we've also seen increases in income, of course, over that period, over the last 20 plus years.
I imagine one party or the other might want to take credit for all of these changes. As you spell it out in the report, this happened some under Democratic Governor Jim Doyle, some under Republican Governor Scott Walker, and so on.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the declining tax burden did accelerate around 2010 or so. Mm-hmm. And folks will recall that's when we did see a shift in the partisan makeup of state government. But yeah, as you allude to, this is not something that's exclusively the province of one party or another. We've seen a reduction in our tax burden under both Democrats and Republicans.
Now, I remember back in the 90s, people would say, hey, we're a high tax state. And then some other people would say, yes, hold on, we're a high tax state with low fees for a wide variety of services and high services compared to other states. What's happening to that other stuff as the tax burden goes down?
Yeah, so this is where we do see kind of a flip side. As we've seen our tax burden decline as a state, we've seen some other declines in certain areas, certain key areas of public spending in our state. And that's kind of, you know, where you see the flip side of that. One of the biggest areas that we look at, the biggest area of spending at state and local spending is education spending. We've seen a pretty significant decline in our education spending as a share of income. Again, trying to account for the ability of Wisconsinites to actually pay for these services. So to give an idea here, in 2023, our state ranked 34th in K-12 spending as a share of income. That's compared to 2000, we ranked 8th. So that's been a big decline. Now, there is somewhat of an important variable to think about there, which is K-12 enrollment. Our state has seen a larger decline than most other states in K-12 school enrollment. However, when we attempt to kind of factor for that and we look at education spending per pupil as a share of income, we've still declined pretty significantly. We were 26th in that metric in 23, down from 11th in 2000.
We're talking about taxes and the state budget with Mark Sommerhauser with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. The group is out with a new report showing that Wisconsin ranked 34th nationally for tax burden in 2023. That's comparing your state and local taxes to your income, continuing a long-term trend of decline. And yeah, Mark, I have conversations all the time we do here on Wisconsin Today with school leaders, with local government leaders saying, okay, you've got a budget surplus somehow. We're seeing these tax increases, but we're getting a little starved here. We're not seeing what we expect, in some cases with the new lawsuit, what we think is constitutionally required by the state. What is happening? Why are those local governments and school boards not seeing what they might expect?
Yeah, so in the most recent state budget that was enacted here last summer, we did see an increase. There was an increase in state funding for special education reimbursement to school districts. However, general school aids, which is kind of the biggest pot of state funding to school districts, was held flat, did not increase. And at the same time, we saw an increase in the revenue limit that was kind of made possible by Governor Evers' use of his veto pen 2 years prior. And what that has done is it's put school districts in a position where they do have an opportunity to increase their revenues by that $325 per pupil amount. But all of that is coming from, if school districts want to do that, all that has to come from an increase in the property tax levy. And so that's kind of going back to your point earlier about some folks saying, hey, wait a minute, my property tax bill's going up. That kind of explains why that's happening.
And I wanted to get into that balance of, okay, we got sales tax, we've got the state income tax you mentioned, and the property tax. And there are arguments over which is the best kind of tax or the right way. You mentioned a decline in state income tax. Sales tax we pay so gradually, right? We never see one bill for that. Is that three-legged stool leaning heavily on that property tax side for many communities?
There's no question that it is the reliance on that leg of the stool has increased here over the last few years. We've seen, steady sort of drumbeat of cuts to the income tax. Our sales tax has pretty much held steady with the notable exception of Milwaukee, right? We did see a new local sales tax put in place in the city of Milwaukee. But outside of Milwaukee, we've kind of been in the same place in terms of sales tax. And yeah, our increase, we've definitely seen an increase in that reliance on the property tax.
Sustainability of this decline in the tax burden. What do you look at in the future now? We can't predict it, but what are you looking at for those big trends?
Yeah, so our report has identified, some factors that are going to make it, at a minimum, more difficult to continue this trend of a declining tax burden. And we're already seeing this year some increases in that property tax due to the factors that we kind of just discussed. There is this kind of mounting pressure on our local governments, both schools, but also our municipalities, counties, that is starting to bubble up. Another key factor is that our personal income growth in Wisconsin has really started to lag the country, especially in about the last 15 years or so. And that makes it more difficult to decrease the tax burden if your income, is not increasing as quickly as the nation. So we see a situation here where there's going to be an increasing amount of tension between do we continue to decrease our tax burden or, do we think about the flip side of that in terms of what it means for services.
We have a state budget surplus this last couple budget rounds, right? And people are looking at this as a pool of money we could do something with, cut taxes, raise school spending, whatever. This did not used to be the norm in Wisconsin budgeting. How have we decreased that tax burden and increased that surplus over time?
Yeah, that's a good question. Few things. I think it's important to realize that while we've been cutting income tax rates, our tax collections have still been increasing. So people hear tax cuts. It's not like we've been cutting the actual amount of tax revenue. We've been cutting the rates, and that's been slowing.
If my rate is lower, but I'm making more money, I'm paying more taxes.
Exactly. That's right. So that's one piece of it. Another really important piece is that the state saw a pretty large infusion of federal aid in the early 2020s during COVID, both going directly to the state's general fund, but also your listeners will recall we had money being sent out to households around that time. Folks spent some of that and paid some of that to the state in terms of tax revenue. So that kind of created a big surplus in the early 2020s that the state had been very slowly spending down ever since.
Big question is, okay, things look pretty peachy state budget-wise with some quibbles, of course. what happens when a recession comes? Because I remember 2008 recession, Wisconsin and lots of other states, all of a sudden that income tax, if people have less income, the state collects less. People are buying less stuff, less sales tax. Are we ready for a shock if and when a recession comes along?
Well, the good news is we're definitely more ready than we were in 2008 because our state was operating on very thin financial margins at that time. Now we do have a surplus. We have essentially money, to use the household analogy, we have some money in our state savings account this time around. So that's the good news. The flip side is that in this most recent budget, we are spending more than we're taking in revenue. We can do that because we have that money in the savings account. But we think it's something that warrants, you know, some caution moving forward.
We used to call that a rainy day fund in Wisconsin. I think there was some legal requirement that we keep a little something in there. Do you see an eagerness from policymakers to spend that down one way or another, whether it's tax cuts or increased education funding or whatever?
Right now, there's definitely some eagerness on the part of policymakers to spend it down. But with the current governor and legislature, they just can't agree on how they want to do that. We'll see. There is apparently some negotiation happening right now between the governor and the legislature on, you know, something that could maybe, put some money toward all of their priorities. So we'll see if that comes to pass. And then, of course, we have, you know, a very consequential election coming up here in November as well.
What is the next data point, briefly, that you are eagerly watching for to add to and extend beyond this report?
I would say one of the next data points for sure will be our spring elections. We're going to see a lot of school districts again going to referenda in those elections. And it'll be interesting to see. For the most part, most voters have tended to approve those referenda. So we'll be interested to see if that trend continues moving forward, which is really going to have a bearing on this whole tax debate.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's Mark Sommerhauser, researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We've been talking about Wisconsin's declining tax burden over the past 25 years, the policies behind that trend, and where we may be headed next.
Coming up, Green Bay has changed its zoning regulations with the goal of creating more housing. Hear from the city planner and the head of Wisconsin's Housing and Economic Development Authority, who says other cities could do it too.
There are so many communities across the state that would benefit from these kinds of zoning reforms. We'd love to see Green Bay leading the charge.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Realtors Association estimates that Wisconsin needs to build 140,000 new housing units in the next 4 years to keep pace with demand. The real estate company Zillow says the country as a whole needs almost 5 million more homes than currently exist.
Communities large and small all over Wisconsin are grappling with a housing shortage. Green Bay recently took some steps to relax its zoning codes to try to make it easier to build certain types of housing.
In just a bit, we'll talk with the head of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority to see what the state is doing about the housing shortage. But first, a look at Green Bay's approach. John Leroy is zoning administrator and senior planner with the city of Green Bay. John, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Zoning codes are vast. They, you know, describe in minute detail how people can use land in a municipality. With this recent revision, what problem is Green Bay trying to address?
Yeah, we're trying to address affordable housing. Recently, the city passed our comprehensive plan update called the 2050 Go Big Green Bay Plan. And with that, city staff and consultants spoke with thousands of folks, residents, community stakeholders, neighborhood folks who brought up a number of different challenges and goals to achieve here in the next two decades. And one of the more pressing issues was affordable housing. With that, some of the key identifiers that were known were to look at working with developers and property owners to redevelop underutilized and vacant housing sites, an attempt to try to promote higher residential densities, to create ADUs or accessory dwelling units, and to modernize the existing code to facilitate missing middle housing, expand mixed use, and encourage gentle density in our neighborhoods.
So when you look at duplexes or, you know, 3 or 4 unit multifamily buildings, has there been demand for this type of housing that the city has been rejecting?
So for duplexes, there's definitely demand that has been out there for folks. And it's not as though the city has been rejecting it per se, but it's the administrative burden that has come into play in the past with duplexes in our typical low density neighborhoods being a conditional use. With the updated zoning code changes, 2-family homes would now become permitted by right. There are still land use development standards that come into play with this as a use, but this would make it an easier process for folks who are looking to create duplexes or 2 families on a lot. For 3 and 4 family units, we haven't had too much from folks asking for necessarily putting up 3 or 4 units on a lot, but I'll note in part, I think that's because the code outright did not allow for that to happen in the past. So it wasn't something that folks were necessarily asking about. When it came to ADUs, while that was primarily not allowed in past code, I think because of popular shows on, say, HGTV, it just became part of the overall public consciousness that this is a thing we've seen in other places. Why can't we do this here? And while 3 and 4 units are definitely a thing that have happened in other communities, maybe it just wasn't as glamorized in things like social media or through a TV show.
You know, as we wrap up here, John, housing doesn't go up quickly. I would imagine these are changes that will have to really infiltrate over time. What other changes can Green Bay do to look at creating more housing more efficiently and quickly?
Right. So part of our basis for when we're examining the code changes was referring back to a study that was done in 2020 that's referred to as the Green Bay Housing Market Study. And with that, there were goals by the year 2040 to create between 3,300 and 7,400 rental units and 4,000 to 9,000 owner-occupied units. And I'd say right now, as we are in 2025, we're meeting those standards, but we want to exceed that. We want to make these housing changes or affordability changes to where people can make houses and units quicker than what they have here now. You know, a lot of the standards that we put forth with this, as far as, say, dimensional regulations to where we've shrunk lot size minimum requirements, they're just that, they're minimums. It doesn't mean that folks have to have a lot size that is smaller, but they have the option. And that's what we're trying to provide here is with these code changes, to have more opportunities for more options for either a person who's a developer and looking to make, say, a new plat, or if you're just an individual homeowner who's looking to maximize opportunities on their existing parcel.
John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That is John Leroy, the zoning administrator and senior planner with the City of Green Bay. Now let's bring in Elmer Moore Jr., CEO and executive director of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, or WEDA. Elmer, thanks for being here.
I'm delighted to get a chance to talk to you again.
We've had the spotlight here on Green Bay, which is loosening its zoning codes in an attempt to encourage the development of more housing. What do you make of this approach?
You know, I don't know that it's a matter of them loosening their codes. I think it's their decision to reimagine what's possible for the future of Green Bay. And I give them all the kudos. They have provided an excellent example for what communities across the state can do to make the development of housing and the attraction of important workforce participants to Green Bay much more likely. You know, the encouragement of ADUs, the use of gentle density strategies. And I really want to note, John did an excellent job describing all the right practices to make Green Bay the community of the future.
What do you mean by a gentle density strategy?
We often believed that the American dream of homeownership meant having space from your neighbors. It meant living in an island unto yourself where maybe you waved over a 6-foot-tall fence, but really we wanted to limit the interaction we have. And what we found is that doesn't actually encourage the pro-social behaviors that make living in a community the rich experience it can be. And it's an expensive use of land. So gentle density encourages more production of housing in smaller spaces. So instead of each house having an acre with lawn on four sides, it's really exciting to encourage folks to build 4 homes on that same acre and potentially direct them so that they're looking at each other, where neighbors can have those vintage style interactions and borrowing sugar and butter and so on. When you can co-locate that gentle density near amenities, whether it's grocery stores, it's healthcare facilities, education, and jobs, what you do is you reduce the reliance on individual transit. You can encourage the use of public transit, which is, by the way, much more environmentally conscious, and it's more cost-effective for families. And it just makes for a better, richer neighborhood and community experience.
There are places when you look out across the country, Minneapolis, California, Oregon, have gone even further than what Green Bay is doing, either eliminating or greatly reducing single-family zoning. Should Wisconsin follow suit?
There are so many communities across the state that would benefit from these kinds of zoning reforms. We love to see Green Bay leading the charge. Everyone is going to be closely watching how it impacts the experience of living there. And I suspect that many communities will follow suit, because what they'll discover is by encouraging gentle density, by allowing for ADUs and these important structures called missing middle housing, they can solve a lot of their own problems relative to population growth, rehousing, aging folks that are living in two-story homes that aren't truly accessible for them, and it will increase affordability.
So in your WIDA portfolio, you're doing a number of things to encourage not only homeownership, but also to make development possible. I wonder, where do you see the biggest return on investment now in enabling more housing across Wisconsin in the future?
I love that question. I wish we had hours and hours to talk about the ways that investing in housing can generate really important social returns. The most important thing I want to offer is when we're talking about housing, healthcare, education, and so many other social determinants of health, it's important that we recognize the returns are often in a different form factor. So I don't think we should be talking about the economic returns of, or the financial returns of just housing. I think what we should talk about is the improvements that we expect to see in education, in public safety, in quality of life. There is no instance where the investment of housing has not worked out better for a community.
So you really see all of those things interconnected: education, public safety, somehow all of it goes back to the housing situation.
You know, I think it would be fun to have peers who work in those other sectors. The debate would be, where does it start? Huh. And we'd all be right if we said it started with our issue. We believe that housing, safe, affordable, sustainable housing, is at the very foundation of what people need to thrive.
Elmer Moore Jr. is CEO and Executive Director of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. And earlier, we heard from Green Bay Zoning Administrator and Senior Planner John Leroy. We've been talking about the housing shortage in Wisconsin and how communities like Green Bay and the state are trying to encourage more workforce housing.
Coming up, 100 years of the nation's first college dance major, which started here in Wisconsin. Dance professors talk about the program's origin story.
Dance at UW-Madison starts in women's physical education in about 1912.
That's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This summer marks the 100th anniversary of the nation's first college dance major, which started right here in Wisconsin at UW-Madison.
In 1926, the idea of dance as an academic study was a radical one, but one woman's unique approach to dance helped it take off. Now, a century later, UW's dance program is thriving.
Andrea Harris is professor of dance history at UW-Madison, and Lee Chiaoping is professor of dance at UW-Madison. Chiaoping, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
And Andrea, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Let's start with you, Andrea, and the origin story here. How did UW-Madison become the first university to offer a dance major?
Yeah, so dance at UW-Madison starts in women's physical education in about 1912. There's a couple of important figures here. One is Margaret Dobler, who was a UW alum herself. She graduated in 1910 with degrees in biology and philosophy. And then after graduation, she was kept on. She was hired to head women's basketball in physical education. And another important figure is Blanche Trilling, who becomes director of the Department of Physical Education for Women in 1912. And right after Trilling is hired, she starts sending out letters to different institutions and potential instructors kind of all across the U.S. seeking people to come to UW to teach folk dance and also what was called aesthetic dancing at the time. This wasn't really that unusual because a big part of physical education in the early 1900s was different programs that were drawn from this larger movement called physical culture, which included things like gymnastics, calisthenics, different exercises that were done with equipment like dumbbells, and dance was a part of that movement too. So there's already dance happening. Blanche Trilling is kind of seeking out dance, and Dobler's here. In the year 1916-1917, Dobler asked for a leave to go to New York City and do graduate work in philosophy. And so Trilling said, well, while you're there, why don't you investigate any new kinds of dance that are going on there? So Dobler does this. She comes back in 1918 with what she thinks is going to be a great new system for teaching dance, and she starts teaching classes in dance, which is exactly what it was called. It was called Dance in the Catalog. It's hugely popular. In 1918, 1919, there's really remarkable growth and demand in dance. So Dobler and Trilling decide that they will propose a degree in dance. And on November 12, 1926, the Board of Regents approve dance as a specialized degree in the course of physical education at UW-Madison.
And this is a first now in universities. Chiaoping, how far has this program come now as you look back over that 100-year milestone?
Oh, it's incredible. We have introduced so many new things in the department, offering things beyond the dance degree to a BFA, to the graduate degrees, to the first Inter Arts and Technology program, to hosting the first screen dance symposium in the world. You know, just on and on. We've had a lot of remarkable events like that take place as part of our history. And of course, this coming year, we will be welcoming our first MFA cohort.
Master of Fine Arts in Dance
with two named options. One of the named options is Creative Research, Culture, and Practice, and the other one is in Screen Dance. And our Screen Dance one, and talking about firsts, will be the first terminal degree offered in the country, if not the world, in Screen Dance.
You said there's a lot of interest in dance early on. Was there pushback? Was there some resistance to the idea that, hey, dance is going to be a university major that people can graduate in?
Not that I've seen in the archive. Mm-hmm. I will say, so, you know, I'm looking at documents in UW Archive right now.
Sure.
And the numbers in those dance classes in, you know, 1918, 1919 academic year, 1919, 1920, 2021, I mean, they're huge. We're talking like 300, 400, 500 people in dance classes. And, you know, even just at the end of World War I, there were fuel shortages at UW-Madison. So Lathrop Hall closed down in the winter because they couldn't heat it. And so they took all of the classes outdoors, volleyball, swimming, basketball, all turned into skating and tobogganing outdoors. But there was such pushback from the dance students who didn't want to lose their dance class that the university consented to opening up the parlor in Chadbourne Hall and letting there be one dance class there, but they had to cap it at 40 people, so first 40 students enrolled. So, yeah, there was a tremendous amount of demand. Dobler and her dancers were being invited by other universities across the country to come and give demonstrations, because as other institutions were trying to start their own physical education and dance curriculums, they were really looking at what Wisconsin was doing. And at that time, the president of UW was Edward Burge, who did put a stop to all that traveling, and he kind of confided that he did not want UW to be known as a dancing school. But it was too late. Other institutions were inviting Dobler all the time, and then if she couldn't come to them, they would come to her. So I would say the interest outweighed any pushback that there was at that time.
We are talking about the 100th anniversary of UW's major in dance, the first in the country. Was it at UW-Madison? We have Lee Chiaoping with us and Andrea Harris, both professors at UW-Madison. Andrea, UW-Madison's dance program has produced some pretty successful dancers, I understand, over the years. Can you share a couple of the alumni stories with us?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, there's so many. I'll just focus on some that really have notable impact. Mm-hmm. And my area is historical, so these are a little bit further back, but Mary Hinkson and Matt Turney both graduated from our program with degrees in the late 1940s. They both danced in the student dance company, which was Orchesis. After graduation, they formed the Wisconsin Dance Group, which was the first multiracial dance group in the state of Wisconsin. And then they went to New York, where they both became members of the Martha Graham Dance Company. Mm-hmm. And they were the first Black members of that company. Another notable one along those same lines is Anna Halprin, who graduated in 1940. And she became one of the main founders of the postmodern dance movement in San Francisco and New York City in the 1960s and 70s. She was Anna Schumann when she was here at UW, and she met her husband, Lawrence Halprin, at the UW Hillel. Lawrence Halprin was a landscape architect who also went on to become quite famous and change his field in the same way that Anna Halprin changed hers. We are having a public lecture in our department on the Halprins on April 9th that I'll just mention. Listeners could find that on the dance department website if they'd like to come.
And Chiaoping, before we let you go, this Margaret Dobler, her teaching methods, I understand, unique, still here in the present, advancing into the future. Can you talk a little bit about those teaching methods and what they mean now?
Yeah, I'm still covering the mirrors up for my dance classes, which is something that she talks about in her text. And there's great value to the inner experience of the students as a means towards learning, towards gaining knowledge. So I think that continues on still in our department. The old-fashioned traditional methods of teaching where the students do exactly what the teacher says and, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, model yourself exactly like this or else your imperfection is not acceptable. I think that is, we're in a different place now. And a lot of our professors, our instructors, all use different kinds of methodologies to teach and to guide their students, to mentor them, to help them to become themselves, their best versions of themselves, to discover new things and to find their own voices. So I think that's one of the ways that we connect back to Dobler, and I think that's also a way forward.
And Chiaoping, even if someone isn't thinking, hey, I want to be a performer, right, or choreographer, mm-hmm. teacher myself, what are the benefits, as you see it, to studying dance, well, even if we're not necessarily majoring in it?
Absolutely. As I said, you know, it's an avenue towards knowledge of oneself, but also to build compassion towards others and understanding, and a way to unravel, you know, the world that we're in. And there's so many ways that the skills that one builds within the dance space, whether it's in a studio or a lecture, would translate in so many rich ways. It's enriching, of course, but in so many rich ways for, you know, whatever they want to apply it towards, you know, the collaborative skills, the resilience that one builds to work on a skill over and over and over again until they get it, right? to find something that seems daunting at first and figure out how to approach it, to look at something that is perplexing and, you know, figure out a way to try to understand it. I think that dance is a great way. I think that's why we still do it. It's just a great way to tune into oneself, to trust your own instincts, to listen to your voice, and also to share and express yourself.
And we'll leave it there. Xiaoping, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you.
And Andrea, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Li Xiaoping is professor of dance, and Andrea Harris is professor of dance history, both at UW-Madison. I talked to them about the 100th anniversary of UW's dance major, which was the first in the nation. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.